Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 7th of Kislev. I occasionally like to take not just one response, but to take a sort of collection. Sometimes there are days when I just don't find any one response that appeals to me, and then sometimes also I chafe at the structure because I always have to pick a response that I can cover in about a half an hour, and that means I can't get responses that are too big. That's a problem. For those I have to be comfortable with days where I can sit down and really cull out lots and lots of stuff to cut it down to size so that we can fit to our, as Mori Virabi of Lichtenstein might have said, our Procrustean bed sarcophagus, where we would like cut it down to our size. That's got problems of its own. But other times, what I can do, as we'll do today, is take a particular meshiv, a particular respondent, and then when they have a bunch of short tshuvot for that day, I can take those tshuvot together and study them, so each one will only take us 3 to 5 or 7 minutes, perhaps, but we'll get a range, and since they're on different times of the year, different years, it will be almost like a mini intellectual biography of that meshiv, of that respondent, for that particular day. For today, the 7th of Kislev, I have several tshuvot that Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, wrote on the 7th of Kislev, and they're about customs, they're about when we meet with others, when we interact with others, when we don't. We'll see, it's a bunch of tshuvot for the 7th of Kislev. We're going to go in reverse chronological order, I think because that's the order in which I found them, but in any case, so from Zayin Kislev of Tufshin Lamed Zayin, from the 7th of Kislev of 5737, which was still 1976. It was November, actually, of 1976. This is the time of the year when you can never know whether you're in the previous year, right? Normally, much of Tufshin Lamed Zayin was in 1977, the last number being the same, but since Rosh Hashanah comes in September-ish time, this is the time of the year when you can't be sure if you've already made it into January of the year or not. In any case, Zayin the Kislev, 7th of Kislev, Tufshin Lamed Zayin, from Igrot Moshe, the fourth volume of Orach Chaim, responsive number Lamed Dalet number 34. He's writing to the rabbi of a certain shul in Paris. And the question was, in a certain shul in Paris, there were people here who were acting in ways differently from the common custom of the place. And the question was, should we allow them to do it? This comes up in a lot of situations. Let's say somebody comes into shul and is doing something differently from the practice of the shul. Now, sometimes the shul doesn't have a practice. That question of when a shul does or does not have a practice, that's a relevant question. Here, the Moshe Feinstein will not get into in this response, but it's a relevant question. But let's assume for a second, for the purpose of this question, the shul has a practice. We're going to see examples will be things of people say a certain nusach hatfilah, they daven with certain words and certain order of davening. That would be one example of it. They do or don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed, we'll talk about. It's not in this response, but we've seen it elsewhere. They shake their lulav a certain way, right? There are two ways that people shake a lulav commonly. In many, many shuls, everybody just does whatever they want. But let's suppose there's a shul that has a firm minhag one way or the other. That's the question. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked about this issue. What happens when somebody comes into a shul and they're handling it a different way from the custom of the place? So he says there's actually two prohibitions. There's two problems in acting differently than the custom of the place. One is there's a prohibition in the Torah. We've seen this before, and I try not to repeat myself too much, but there is a prohibition in the Torah called lotit kodudu. The simplest meaning lotit kodudu is, you know, to scratch yourself, your body, when somebody has passed away as a sign of mourning. But the Gemara takes it to also mean, in a full halachic sense, as we'll see in this response, it's a deoraita problem, it's a Torah problem, as the Rav Moshe Feinstein says, who me deoraita, it's a Torah problem, to create splits in the Jewish people. So for the Jewish people to have split customs, to act in different ways from each other on halachic issues, on matters of ritual practice, that is a problem lo tit kodudu. How we have so many Jews who act so differently from each other in so many ways, that we've seen before in discussions of lo tit kodudu, but so we won't go into it right now, but the answer is there are exceptions to this. There are ways in which it can happen that Jews have different customs and different practices, but we're not allowed to create more of those, and that's a loaded go-to-do problem. So that would be a do-right issue, a Torah issue. To demonstrate that this is a full do-right issue, Rav Moshe mentions that the Kesef Mishnah wonders about the fact that halachically, let's suppose somebody lost a relative, from they're supposed to born, and they scratched at their body in the way that violates lotit godu. That violates the other meaning of lotit godu, that you're not allowed to scratch at your body in mourning over a person who's passed away. And let's suppose there were two witnesses there, and it was a time when Jewish courts were fully functioning, and the two witnesses bring the man to court, and they say, we told him there's a pasuk in the Torah that says lotit godu, you can't scratch yourself in this way over a person who passed away, and he did it, or she did it anyway, having acknowledged the warning. The halach is that the court would give that person the punishment that comes with violating a prohibition in the Torah, which is malkot, which is the flogging. So the Kesavisha says, but I don't understand, if lotit go to do is also learned in the Gemara as reflecting another deoraita halacha of the one we're talking about, the Jews cannot act differently from each other in any ways, other than the exceptional ways, but otherwise they can, but they can, then it's what's called a lav shebichlalut. It would be a pasuk in the Torah. We have such psukim, other psukim as well, where a verse, well, the same verse refers to two or more prohibitions or two more or more issues. That's called a lav shebichlalut. It's a lav, it's a prohibition in the Torah that covers more than one. And the principle in the Gemara is that a lav shebichlalut is not susceptible to malkot. It's not susceptible to lashes. So whatever the Kesavish's answer isn't important to Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's just proof that he understands, the Kesavish understands, that when the Gemara says that the loaded godudu applies to also not having Jews act differently from each other, having developing different customs from each other in prohibited ways, that that's a full Torah prohibition. So that's one issue with this. Whoever this person is coming to a shul in Paris and acting differently. The second one is, there's a rabbinic prohibition, and this is what we know from things like second day of Yom Tov in Israel, outside of Israel, that we're not allowed to be mishaneh mipnei hamakloket. The worry is that when people do things differently from each other, it leads to... So the question is, does makloket mean, the simplest reading of makloket is that it means strife and dissension? And I have over the years come to wonder whether it might also just mean division. People feel differently from each other. They feel like that one's not the same as me. We're not the same group. And that would be also a problem, machloket. Whichever one it means, it's clear that that's an issue the Gemara is bothered by. So if, let's say you're from a place where a certain kind of food is permitted, and other people think that it's prohibited, so we don't think that you're allowed to eat it in front of them casually because we think it leads to machloket, to division. That would be the second version of what Moshe's talking about here. So I walk into a shul, they dive an x-ray, let's say they say Heidi, and the whole prayer of Heidi before Baruch Sheamar, and I come from a custom and a practice that says Hodu after Baruch Sheamar. If I clearly dive in that differently from them, that might lead to machloket. So Rav Moshe says this halacha d'rabbanan applies af b'minhagim shikavu isurim ktsat v'chol shechein b'isurim gimurim. This applies to customs where there's only a little bit of a technical legal aspect, of a technical halachic prohibited aspect, but it also applies to things that have complete aspects. So for example, tefillin on chol hamoed. The question is, do you wear tefillin or don't wear tefillin? So those who wear tefillin or think you should wear tefillin, if they see somebody not wearing tefillin, they think that person is neglecting a positive commandment of the Torah. The Torah obligates us to wear tefillin. Here's this man, this Jew, just not wearing tefillin when he's supposed to be. So for them, that other Jew is doing the wrong thing. And the other way around, the people who say we don't wear tefillin on Kol HaMoed because it's a moed, because it's a holiday, the same way we don't wear tefillin on the first day of Sukkot or the first day of Pesach, because those are holidays, and they are an oath, they are a sign between us and Hashem. That became the question about Chol HaMoed as well. Is Chol HaMoed enough of an oath, a sign between us and Hashem, that we don't need the oath, the sign between us and Hashem, of wearing tefillin? So Moshe Feinstein's point is that whichever way you take it, whichever answer you give, the people who don't do it that way are, in some sense, violating the halacha. Now, they think they're doing the right thing, so it's not like you... So that's a split on halachic issue. And that would be a problem, Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying, of A, lo go to do, and B, of al tishanev b'nei machloket, of changing things and creating a machloket. So too, he says, that would be true for shinu yehendischot. If the general practice in a shul is to say the words of the liturgy in one way, and this person is going to say it another way, he says it might not be a loaded go-to-do problem, because, interesting question, because with all of the nuschaot that we have in davening floating around, with all the different practices, there's, you know, Ashkenazim, there's Sefaradim, there's Edot Mizrach, there's Nusach Sfarad, which is a Kabbalistic version. It's not really Sfarad, it's a Kabbalistic thing that has some additions into it. There's the Italian Jews. There's all these different variations on the liturgy, and therefore, you might have thought it was loti godu. He says he doesn't think it is, or it might not be, because the Ikar Nuskei HaBrachot is the same. Because there's enough evidence in the Gemara as to the basic form of the liturgy and the basic form of the blessings, that if you open up a Sidur from a custom, from a practice that's not yours, you can basically follow it. I actually recently was in Rome for a Shabbat, and I davened, you know, in the shul, and their liturgy isn't the same as the one that I'm used to, and their pronunciation and their tunes aren't the same as the one I'm used to. And I found that when I opened the Sidur, their Sidur, and I followed along in their Sidur, I was able to follow the Chazan, and I could see what they were changing. They were changing some things significantly and some things not that significantly. But as Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying here, Ikar Nusach HaBrachot, the essential form of the blessings, is all the same. So therefore, that might be close enough that it doesn't create a problem of loti godu. It's not a split among the Jewish people. It's not as if, you know, if I say davening and there are 1,000 words of davening and I change 2 of the words from what you change and they're not in the bracha, in the blessing that summarizes it all, that encapsulates it all, that might not be a loti godu issue. So maybe there's not a loti godu issue, but there is al tishanem neham machloket. That in changing, it might create machloket. Now, machloket here again, I think, doesn't have to mean that people actually fight with me about it. Because the answer to that might be people might say, well, maybe back in the time of the Gemara, that would have created machloket, the people getting so upset, they would have fights about it. But we're more tolerant, we're more pluralistic, whatever the right words would be. I don't think that's necessarily the claim, because I think Alta Shinem Minam Machloket is like an outshoot of Lotit Godidu. It's not only a machloket of people will fight with you, it's machloket of people are going to separate and be further apart than they had to be. I do this and you do this. So if a person comes to this shul in Paris, Moshe Feinstein says, and he wants to say Vidui before Nefilat HaPayim. So now we already learned, this apparently is a shul where the Nusach, the liturgy, is Ashkenazic. And in the Ashkenazic liturgy, on a regular weekday, after the repetition of the Shemone Esrei, of the Amidah, by the Chazan, we say Tachan, what we call Tachan, which is called in Halacha, Nefilat Apayim, where you put your head down on your arm or your forearm, and you say some more pleadings to Hashem. In the Sephardic custom, after the repetition of the Amidah, before they get to the Nefilat HaPayim, they'll say every day, they'll say A of Vidui, meaning they'll say the Ashamnu that Ashkenazic Jews only say in the course of Slichot and on Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim. They'll say it every day, or they'll say it every day, I think. And they'll also say Yud Gimel Midot. If they have a minyan together, they'll say they'll recite the 13 attributes of mercy, of Hashem's mercy, that we have in the Torah, that we, that Ashkenazim only say, again, in the course of Slichot and on Yom HaKippurim. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, he can only do the Vidui, the Ashamnu, if he can do it in a way that nobody else will know it, which would mean, presumably, if he couldn't beat his chest, because if you're beating your chest, everybody knows what you're doing. They say, oh, what's he doing? He's doing Ashamnu, but today we don't do that today. That would be a problem, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, and you're not allowed to do it. And you certainly can't do the Yud Gimel Midot, he says, because to say the Yud Gimel Midot, you need a minion. That's our general assumption. So today, there might be a way, you might say, well, I'll lane the Yud Gimel Midot. It might be true that if one reads it out of the Torah, it reads it as if they were reading the Torah, that would be allowed. Moshe Feinstein doesn't get into that, so we won't either. So that would be a problem. You'd have to gather a minyan. To gather a minyan for Yud Gimel Midot is clearly a division, a change, and that, he says, you're not allowed to do. The only thing that he says you should be allowed to do is, if this person has the custom, the practice, of putting on tefillin at mincha as well, that you shouldn't stop them. Because the truth is, anybody can put on tefillin at mincha. It's not a custom not to put on tefillin at mincha. It's not a matter of custom. It's a matter of, we mostly don't think of ourselves as so able to control ourselves. Remember that wearing tefillin is supposed to be an awe-inspiring religious experience, such that the person doesn't engage in certain bodily functions, right? They wouldn't expel air, and they're always thinking about their tefillin. The common practice has become that most of us assume we're not so capable of controlling ourselves that we'll do that multiple times in a day. We put it on in the morning because you have to put on tefillin. We have a mitzvah to fulfill, so we fulfill the mitzvah. But once we are done with fulfilling the mitzvah, we don't put it on again because we're worried that we won't handled it well. So there is some arrogance in some of it. Now, again, if he comes from a custom where everybody does it, it's not arrogance for him. But there's some you might have thought that he's putting it on where most people don't do it. But Moshe Feinstein doesn't think that qualifies as a separate custom that should be an issue. But the rest of them, the rest of these changes this person wants to do, Moshe says he should object. And then, and this is Rav Moshe Feinstein again writing in 1976, we said, so he's an elderly man, he's 81 years old. And I paused to note this and to stress it because I think, at least for me, maybe you've had a different experience of Moshe Feinstein, I think the impression of Moshe Feinstein has always been that he's this nice, gentle man who tries to get along with people, tries to help people, his tshuvot often have many leniencies that help people get on in their lives, and all of that is true. I am not going to question any of that. I just think that sometimes we don't notice other elements as well. So here, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein closes by saying you have to stop him from doing it. You have to object to his doing it because he's acting differently than everybody else. So today, if I said to you, most Jews, even observant Jews, even very observant Jews, when you see so-and-so acting differently than the custom of a community or of a place, what do you think we should do about it? I think many of us would just say, well, just ignore it. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, V'gam l'kufo behatra'ah, to warn him, this is apparently somebody who has a job with this shul or this community, and to tell him, you can't keep doing that, and if you keep doing that, we're going to have to remove you from your position. And he can't do this even if he's not serving his chazan on that day. It's not that he's doing it in public in that sense. He's doing it sitting in his seat, but he's doing it in a way that's noticeable. So Rav Moshe does seem to say, if he wants to say vidui in his tachanun, he wants to say Hashem nebagadnu, but he doesn't bang his chest, and nobody knows what he's saying. So what you say to yourself privately, that might be okay because it's private. But to act in front of others, in a way that others are bound to see, in a way that's different from the custom of the community, Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that's a prohibition. It might be in some cases, it is in some cases, they don't write the prohibition, a Torah prohibition of lo tidgodlu. In other cases, it's a rabbinic prohibition of al tishanah b'nei hamachloket, and therefore it's not allowed, and therefore we have to make sure to stop that person. That is his response from the 7th of Kislev for Tafshin Lamed Zayin. 2 years earlier, Zayin of Kislev of Tafshin Lamed Hey, 1974, he talks about where we put Hanukkah candles, right? Hanukkah is coming up. Zayin of Kislev is a week before Hanukkah. It's 2 weeks before Hanukkah. So where do you put the Hanukkah candles? So in the Gemara, Hanukkah candles are supposed to be placed outside the house, in the doorway to the house, or the doorway to one's yard in front of one's house. So the Rambam already noticed that we don't do that anymore because, for various reasons, there's a whole discussion about why we don't light outside anymore. In many places in Israel today, they do light outside. But since we don't light outside anymore, he says, it doesn't matter where you light, where you put them, you're putting them in the house, put them in the house. Right? Because the only people who care about it are people who are in the house themselves or who come into the house. So as long as it's in a place where they can see it, then you can do it. So Moshe Feinstein points out, but the custom became to put it near the window. Right? The custom became to put it near the doorway, like it had been on the outside of the doorway. And then you'd put it, if you're going to do that, you might put it on the right side of the doorway, because the left side of the doorway as a person is entering that doorway. You're doing it on the inside, but you might put it on the left side anyway, because there was this tradition in the Gemara of being nice if a person can walk into their house and be surrounded by mitzvah. So the mezuzah goes up on the right side of the doorway. So if you put the menorah on the left side, then the person is surrounded by mitzvah as they come in. Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't think that's necessarily obligatory, because that was only once you were already putting it outside and you were talking about where to put it. So there was this nice reason, but it was not essential to the mitzvah of Hanukkah that it's meant to be a counterpart to the mezuzah, such that the person walking to their house will get both mitzvahs in, and therefore you don't have to do it. It's if once you're placing it outside, you have two choices. You might as well put it on the left with the mezuzah on the right. So nowadays, he says, we don't light outside, and the whole piersum, the whole letting people know about the miracle is really mostly for the people who live in that house or come to visit that house. So there's no reason why it has to be on the right or the left of the doorway. And that's why the Magen Avraham wrote, and this is what Rav Moshe Feinstein, the same thing we do, is what is common practice, that if you have a window that's close to the outside, that's in some place in the public eye, you put it in the window, because then you get the persimmonies of people seeing it going by. It's not outside the front door, but it's a place where people can see it, And that is what he says his own custom was, that he lights in the window that is visible to those outside, and that's what his father did, and many Gedolei Hador. So that's really, ideally, where the, if it's possible, that's where the candles should be placed. Okay, that is Rav Moshe Feinstein from the 7th of Kislev of Tavshin Lamed Hey. Going back now a little bit further, 22 years earlier, to Tavshin Yud Gimel, November 1952, Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked a question by the Bubba of a Rebbe. The Bubba of a Rebbe was already in America, apparently, during the war, and he had, during the war, he knew Jews. One of the tragedies of World War II was that there were people who knew more than other people, or knew more about what was going on, and there were people trying very hard to do various things to save Jews. Some of them succeeded somewhat, and some of them succeeded less so, but there were many people trying a lot more than we think that there were people trying. The Bubba of a Rebbe, during the war, had been trying to help save people, and he had borrowed money to try to get Jews out of Europe. And he borrowed this money, and he had planned, he had expected, that he was going to be able to get the money back from members of his community. So he borrowed this money, he sent it to Europe to try to save Jewish lives, and he thought the whole community would then help him repay the money. And now, the people who lent him the money, so this is a bunch of years later, but the people who lent the money want him to pay them back, and he doesn't, apparently it's either difficult for him to do so, or he's not getting the communal support that he thought he would, or he doesn't really have it. He's not having an easy time paying back this money. And he writes to Rav Moshe a question about the issue, and he says in the question, this is what Rav Moshe Feinstein is reporting, he has a question that, you know, I don't really have to pay it back. And the reason why he thinks he doesn't have to pay it back is because it was money that he borrowed in the context of trying to save lives. And so his claim was that if I take money from other people in the act of saving lives, and then that money gets destroyed, that's not my responsibility halachically. But he says, Rav Moshe Feinstein quotes him as saying, but because he was accustomed to doing the right thing, to being even better, to live by midat chasidut, to live by the standard not of what I'm required to do, but by the standard of what's the right thing to do, and acting even lifnim mishurat hadin, beyond the letter of the law. So what he wants to do is he wants to pay slowly, in small amounts. And he also, since he thinks that he's not legally, halakhically required to do this, thinks he can therefore choose who to pay off first and when in the way that he wants to. That was part of his, I think, approach to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, when he writes this, he says, Mechila mikva gudlato, or kitra gudlato, he says, I'm sorry for having to say this, but I think it's not true. I think that you're completely halakhically obligated to pay back this money. And this gets into the question of, let's suppose that somebody's chasing somebody else, or somebody's chasing me. So if somebody's chasing me, and as I'm running, I break things to be able to get away, right? If you think about the movies, a classic chase scene, and I'm going everywhere, and I'm destroying things, and I'm completely tossing things, right? Is that allowed or not allowed is one question. And another question is, let's say it's allowed, do I or don't I have to pay back what I've damaged? So the Rosh Hashanah finds the point that the halacha of the Gemara is, kesheitzil b'mon acherim chayav l'shalem. If a person saves himself or saves somebody else, but uses money that belongs to a third, an uninterested party, in the course of so doing, you have to pay it back. There was an opinion in the Gemara that said that the person who's running to save an innocent victim, if that person destroys things along the way, that person will not have to pay it back. That's because Rav Moshe finds, that's the opinion of Rabbah. Then Rabbah says there in the Gemara that if you don't save that, then people won't save each other. So you have to save that in order to be able to, if the person who does the saving legitimately broke the stuff because he needed to get it to save the person, then we don't make them pay back. But that's only if they destroyed something. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that's in terms of din mazik, of having destroyed things. But to be patur from stealing, or that you borrow money, you don't have to pay it back, there's no such takana, there's no such thing. And even by a mazik, even by destructive, that's the only things that were in his way. He'd have to show that this was necessary to get out of his way. I mean, let's say I drive a car, and I decide to drive it and slam it to 15 cars along the way that I didn't need to as I was saving somebody else's life. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if I didn't need to do it, then it's not going to be this patur, this freedom from obligation doesn't come into play. And therefore, the only real debate between that the Bava Rebbe could have with these other people that he was discussing was whether or not the amount that he owed was, there was a debate about whether he owed him $3,000 or $10,000, because I think he had promised that he had paid him back $10,000 for whatever reason. But if whatever they had given him wasn't worth the $10,000, then he has the right to say, I was just talking to you. And that gets into there's a whole discussion in the Gemara about when a person who needs something desperately from another person who's causing him problems can say he was fooling him. So an example in the Gemara that Rav Moshe Feinstein refers to is in Bava Kamma Kuftet Zayin Amud Aleph, in 116a, the Gemara talks about a person, let's say the person's running away from prison, and in the Gemara's time, you're running away from prison, we assume that you were right to run away from prison. Their confidence in the government was such that they didn't really believe that they were properly in prison. And you get to a bridge or a passageway, and there used to be, let's say there wasn't a bridge, sorry, there was somebody who would take you along the river, right, who would take you from one side of the river to the other. So, and he says, I'm on my lunch break, but you got to get away because they're chasing you. So he says, so you can say to him, I'll pay you, and you may even exorbitant price, and then when you get to the other side, you're allowed to only pay him the true price, whatever the price would have been, because that sometimes you're allowed to do and say, I was just tricking you into doing what you're supposed to do for me anyway. So the Beit Din, a court, would have to judge which way that issue goes, and what the Bava Rebbe promised these people, whether what he promised them was an appropriate amount or was exorbitant just to get them to lend him the money. But fundamentally, he does have to pay it back, even though it was money that he had borrowed and taken for the purposes of saving lives. So that was 1952. Reaching even further back, and this is the earliest one we'll get, Rav Moshe Feinstein from Zion Kislev, 7th of Kislev, Tof Resh Sadi Tet, which is 1938. Rav Moshe Feinstein was in Yoredeya. I haven't told you where the other ones are, so I apologize. I told you the first one was in the fourth volume of Or Chaim. The second one that we did from Tof Shin Lamed Hei, which was about where to place Chanukah candles, was also the fourth volume of Or Chaim in Kuf Chof Hei, Rishonim 125. The third one we did, which was from 1952, Zayin Kislev Tof Shin Yud Gimel, was from Choshen Mishpat Part 2, the second volume, the second time he came to Choshen Mishpat Responsa, Siman Samach Gimel, Chapter 63. And this one is from Yoredeya Volume 3, Pei Tet, Responsa 89. It's from the 7th of Kislev Tof Resh Tadi Tet of 1938, really 56, 99, but 1938, and it discusses the fact that the Gemara in Chagiga Yud Gimel says, Ein Mosrin Divrei Torah La'akum. We're not supposed to teach, it seems to be, we're not supposed to teach Torah to Akum, right, to non-Jews, and the reason the Gemara gives there is a verse in Tehillim that we say in the course of our Halalukas, Lo Asachin Rogai, Mishpatim Bayidim, that Hashem hadn't given Torah to any other nation and had not taught them Mishpatim, right, the laws of the Torah. Tosus there says, there's also a Torah prohibition, perhaps, because the Torah prohibition would be Lifnei Iver, because the Gemara also says that non-Jews aren't allowed themselves to learn Torah. There's a debate in the Gemara as to why they're not allowed to learn it, either because it's a morasha to us, it's an inheritance to us and not to them, or it's like morasha, it's like we're engaged to Hashem, not them, it's a whole discussion. But fundamentally, they're not allowed to. So that's the reason we can't teach them, because Lifnei Iver. Tosafot says, no, but let's say there's a non-Jew who would also teach them the same Torah, then there's no Lifnei Iver issue, because if the person that I'm helping, you know, do something wrong, could have done it without me, that's not a Lifnei Iver problem. That comes up in a lot of contexts, but Lifnei Iver is a prohibition of we can't lead people to sin in ways that they couldn't sin on their own even if we weren't there. But if they can do it themselves, it doesn't mean we're allowed to do it, but it sometimes does mean it. So here too, that would not be an issue. So there's an additional problem of this verse that we're learning from, this verse in Tehillim, that teaches us an additional problem of that issue. And then Rav Moshe Feinstein points out that the Gemara Ketubah says you can't do it to your slave either, la'avdo, meaning your non-Jewish slave who was partially converted to Judaism. You can't teach that him Torah. And Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks at this point, now 1938, Feinstein is a relatively young man, he's 43 years old. At this point he says, and I noticed it because I found this Sri D'Eish, which was not written on the 7th of Kislev, and we won't have time to get into, who also raises this question of, can you teach Torah to non-Jews and when can you? He's actually talking about, let's say you're going to speak to an entire audience, and much or some of the audience is Jewish, but some is not, are you allowed to continue teaching Torah in that situation? That's for another time, maybe we'll come to it, but he says there the exact opposite of Rosh Feinstein says here, because Rosh Feinstein says the fact that the halacha paskins in some places that we can't teach it to our avadim, he says that's why you don't find the general prohibition being written about so much, because they assumed you'd learn it from the fact that you can teach it to your slaves. The Sri D'Eish thinks that they're not comparable, that the prohibition of teaching Torah to a slave is not the same as prohibition, it's not exactly the same, such that that's not the answer. But we'll have to leave that for another time. But What does come up as the last piece of this tshuva, and the last piece that we'll see together, is that the Gemara in Bava Kama Daf Lamed Chet talks about what we think of as being the translation into the Septuagint. It talks there about that there were kings of Rome, and they hired Jewish people to come to them and teach them Torah. So if it's a prohibition of the Pasuk in Tehillim, Kuf Mem Zayin, Lo Asaf Edom Goy, how could they do that? And that eventually leads to the Septuagint, and there's all sorts of issues. Tosfos there said already, Moshe Feinstein says, that they did it against their will, Shebaal Korcham Asu, because the ruler told them to. And the Tosfos it said, and there's no obligation to give up your life to avoid doing this. Now, that's an interesting claim, because that would get into questions of what counts as a shemad or not a shemad. Here you'd have to say that when they told them to do it, they weren't telling them to do it because they wanted them to grasp the Torah. They just were interested in learning Torah. And that if a non-Jew tells you under threat of your life to violate the Torah for things that are just a matter of their pleasure and their convenience, we're not required to refuse in that sense. So if the king tells you to do something, even if it's a violation of Torah, sometimes you have to do it. That's where Moshe Feinstein is understanding it. But when it comes to their seven mitzvot, when it comes to the Noahide laws, so there, Tosfos points out, not only are we allowed to teach them, it's good to teach them. And Moshe Feinstein says, even though there are people who disagree, he thinks it's not true. It's like the Tosfos, it's mutar, it's allowed, because we're helping them fulfill the Torah the way that's appropriate to them and important to them. But everything else, he says, including Agadot, in terms of including, you know, the stories of Chazal, that we're not supposed to be doing, even though he says, shalom, in terms of creating peace, we shouldn't be publicizing this. So it's a little bit of a problem, because there may be non-Jews listening to this shiur right now, and if they've come this far with me, then I apologize a little bit. It's a sense of the exclusiveness of our relationship to Torah, is this idea of lo asachen goy. It's a verse in Psalms 147. That's where Moshe Feinstein was building off of. So we have, for the 7th of Kislev, 4 tshuvot of Moshe Feinstein that we saw very, very quickly and very briefly together. They're relatively brief tshuvot, and we've seen them relatively briefly. The requirement to follow the minhag of a place, in, at least in terms of whatever anybody else can tell, and not to obviously be acting different than they. The question of where to light Hanukkah candles in our times, when we no longer light outside our windows and outside our doors. The question of what kinds of loans we have to pay off if they were done to save other Jews' lives. And then finally, the question of learning Torah for Jews and for non-Jews. Response of the day for the 7th of Kislev. Have a great day.